Mr. Dave H. from Joplin.
You know you're in trouble when she was more impressed with the Southern University baseball team than the guy she was going to introduce. I always take this off, if not because I'm going to watch it, it just makes Harlan feel a little better. My name is Dave Hall, and I'm an alcoholic. Real grateful to be here today. And she found out more about me in a minute last night than she did the 45 minutes we had breakfast this morning, I'll guarantee you. But she found more about honest about me this morning with my wife there. You know, it's kind of hard to lie when they're there. And some of you know what I'm talking about when I say that. Before I forget, I want to thank Jack, who I've not met yet, for calling me and inviting me to be here this weekend. I understand. You get real nervous. You better get real nervous when you find out the guy invited me is not here today. And I pray for Jack. I understand he had some surgery and he's going to try to make it tonight. But I want to thank Joe and the rest of the committee for your hospitality. The beautiful fruit basket that was in my room, I don't eat fruit. I'm a meat and tater man, but yeah, it's pretty good to throw at your wife when you want to get her attention. So there's been plenty of that going on this weekend. It's kind of hard to follow a jet fighter pilot. You know, I identify. You know, when he was talking about that 360, I did that one night off the top of a bar stool when my wife came to get me. So, and that's about, he lost me after that, you know, and until he started talking that drunk talk, and, you know, I talked that real well. I come to you this morning unscarred by education, and I'm sure I don't need to tell you that now because you've already figured that out. And my home group is the newcomer group in Joplin, Missouri. I haven't found necessary to take a drink since June 13, 1984, and there's not anybody ever knew me who's not grateful for that. It's really a privilege and an honor to be asked to do anything in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this committee's done all the work, now we get to play, and that's what we do here is we just come here and we gather as a fellowship, and we enjoy the time we're here together, and we take what we learn and go home and put it to use. You know, it's real easy for me to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just when I go outside the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, out there where we live, the other 24 hours that I have to live with me, and, you know, what this program has taught me is, you know, to practice these principles on a daily basis is what I have here is a daily reprieve, and that's all I have, and this continues what I do in this program. And what you're going to hear today is a lot of what I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we do a lot of stupid things when we're out there drinking alcohol. But I carried some of those character defects right inside the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of the things I've done here I'm not proud of, but it's my story, and you know, I'm here to share that. I came from a good home. You know, there was no alcoholism in my family. You know, my dad, he worked real hard, and I have an older sister and a younger brother, and you know they don't drink very seldom. You know, my sister's one of those two drinks, and I'm starting to feel it and quit. And my brother, you know, when he drinks, he likes to get drunk because he thinks that's what they make alcohol for. But when he gets drunk, then he gets sick, and he don't want to drink for 2 or 3 months. And yeah, you know, I never did understand that kind of drinking. And you know, when I got drunk and got sick, I wanted to get drunk again and get over being sick. And they never understood that. I was raised in that home, and I never felt a part of because I just felt that I was different. And what I've come to find out in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the reason I felt that way is because I was different. You know, I wasn't doing the things they was doing, and I didn't feel the way they felt. And I had nothing to do with them. Nothing, absolutely nothing to do with them. I felt that way because of the things I was doing. When I was growing up, I started running with the kids that we like to find things before they was officially lost, you know, and we would just do anything we could to just run the streets, and we called it fun, you know, and it was, compared to what we did then and what they're doing today, it was fun. You know, we didn't have no drive-by shootings today. You know, the other day I was talking to a guy, He said he was standing at a payphone. He said he heard this noise going off, and he looked all around, and these guys drove by and were shooting paint guns at him. And I thought, man, I've never tried that. That sounds like fun to me. I could do that kind of drive-by shooting. And, that's the kind of things we was doing growing up. I got to high school, no fault of my own, you just keep going to school one day at a time, and I think Bud said it, it's real interesting to follow someone like Bud. You come up here and he stands up here for 5 minutes, gets everybody pissed off, and then gives you the mic. But it wasn't smart guys I was running with, we was little terrorists, and we just terrorized the neighborhood, and we got to be 15 years old, and that's what you'll do if you don't die. If you live one day at a time, you'll grow up to be 15. And we started borrowing a guy's car, a friend of mine's dad's car, that left town every weekend, and we'd go over to Kansas, and we discovered alcohol. And, I'm not a social drinker. The first time I drank alcohol, I got drunk, I blacked out, and I passed out. And the last time I drank alcohol, I got drunk, I blacked out, and I passed out. And I'd like to tell you that's what happened from the time I started drinking till the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. The truth is when you live in blackouts, you don't know what happened a lot of that time. And I don't like the way they described it to me, I think they exaggerated some. I don't remember doing some of the things that they said I did, and it was awful embarrassing when they was talking about them. So, I don't repeat a lot of the stories. But I want to tell you, I got out of high school and got that diploma. They'll give you a diploma in Missouri if you can do a D minus, and that's what I did. I got through high school on D minuses, and you don't learn a lot that way, but you get a diploma, and that's all I needed. My dad told me before I left home I had to have a diploma, and he didn't tell me I had to have an education, so I got the diploma and left home. And I got out there and started drinking like we drank. I'd get drunk and I'd wreck cars and I'd go to jail, and I didn't like jail. A lot of people, I guess, like jail. They go to jail for a long time. I talked to a guy one time, he'd been in jail 27 times. I'm like, man, I'd like to went to that jail. You didn't want to go to jail I went to 27 times. But it wasn't my deal. So, I made a promise to myself that if I was going to drink alcohol, I was going to drink alcoholic successfully and stay out of jail. And I did. When I come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my best friend was a prosecuting attorney. And if you have best friends who are prosecuting attorneys, you don't have to go to jail a lot. You get real paranoid, but you don't go to jail a lot. But I got married when I was 19 years old because my friends were getting married and they were settling down and they wasn't wrecking cars and they wasn't getting in trouble. So I got married. Error in judgment, bad mistake. Should have never got married. I'm supposed to go to work, supposed to come home with a paycheck. Rules that was never explained to me when I got married. And I can't tell you a lot about that marriage. I left my hometown about 6 months after we got married because not only do I have my folks talking to me about my drinking, I've got a wife talking to me about my drinking, I got in-laws talking to me about my drinking, and I don't like to talk about drinking, I like to drink, and I just never thought it was amusing to sit around and talk about drinking. Let's either do it or let's don't do it, and they was the don't do it times, and I was wanting to do it, so I got out of there, and we moved to Kansas City, and I went to start a career in the grocery business, and that's what you do when you're uneducated, you got to go to work, and you don't get a position, you get a job. And I never liked to work, but I started working because I was told to go to work and I get a paycheck and I was supposed to bring it home, but I usually stop somewhere and forget to take the check home. And she didn't understand that, and we had a little girl in that marriage, and I don't remember a lot, and I do remember one day I was coming to in the back bedroom of a mobile home we was living in, and I woke up or came to that morning and I was full of fear. And I'm sure you understand that. I'm sure some of you have been there. And I didn't know what I did the night before, but I knew it wasn't good. And I tried to listen because I heard them talking out there, and I heard a lady tell my wife, said, if you love that baby, you'll leave. You'll take that baby and leave before he really hurts someone. And I couldn't figure out what I did, but when I got enough nerve to get up to go out there, it came to me the night before in a drunken rage. I had threw a brick through a storm door and missed that baby by inches. And I didn't feel good that morning. I didn't feel good, and I'll tell you why I didn't feel good. I didn't feel good because I wasn't raised to do those things. I had never seen that. I had never had to watch that. That's not the way my folks raised me. And I didn't feel good about that. And I made a promise that morning that I had every intention in the world to keep. And I promised her that if I couldn't cut down on my drinking, I would quit drinking. Because I didn't want to put her and that baby through that. But see, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know how to quit drinking. You know, I can quit, you know, Scott, what's it, 8 weeks? God, can you imagine going without alcohol? Man, your fingernails had to be that long to go without a drink for 8 weeks. You know, I could do 8 days maybe, and that's just how much heat was on. But I would get so miserable, I'd make them miserable, and they'd say, go drink, and that's all I was waiting for, is that, go drink, and I'd go drink. And that marriage ended, and it wasn't long after that marriage ended, you know, I got married again, and I married a high school sweetheart, and I had dated this girl in high school, and, you know, she came from an alcoholic family, and I say that because her dad committed suicide through this disease, and it wasn't pretty. It was pretty ugly to watch, and but her dad was, when I was young and we was dating, he was always my hero. He was the guy that come sliding in the driveway sideways, and he'd jump out of that car, and whoever was in that car with him would wait until he'd go in the house, and he'd go in the house, start a fight, and they'd all leave, and then when they'd all leave, him, that person was in that car, would go in the house, and man, what a life. What a life. You know, this is the best of two worlds. Instantly, he became my hero. And, you know, I watched that guy drink, and then he became a real violent drunk. And, you know, I swore I would never be like that. I would never be like that because I didn't want to be like that. We got married, and, you know, I thought, you know, I took one of them spot check inventories that's talked about in the 12 by 12, you know. She had a little girl and I had a little girl, so I thought, well, it's taken care of. We don't need no little girls. And about 3 months later, she gets pregnant. We have a little girl. Now we got her little girl, my little girl, our little girl, and there's just a lot of little girls running around there. And, you know, they think it's a good idea. I go to work on a regular basis and bring home paychecks. And, you know, I don't do those two things well. I can do one or the other, but not both. You know, if I go to work, then I think that money ought to be drinking money, and that's what I do. And, you know, I start calling my father to wire me money the day after I get paid. And, you know, the non-alcoholics, they ask the weirdest questions. You know, my dad used to say, you know, son, how did you lose your car? I said, that thing weighs 3,000 pounds, boy. You know, how do you lose a car? You know, I said, Dad, you know, if I knew where I lost it or how I lost that car, I wouldn't have lost it. It's pretty obvious. And, you know, it's not the answer he wanted. You know, I can almost get you killed. And he would say, you know, son, you got paid last night. You know, where's your money? Well, it's obvious it's not here, Dad, because if it was here, that my wife would have it. You know, I just need money. They never understood. I never knew what they wanted me to say. You know, I used to tell my dad the truth, and it was the God's truth, and he never knew that. I'd say, I don't know. And I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue why I was living the life I was living. All I knew is when I did not drink alcohol, I was irritable, restless, and discontent. I couldn't stand to live with me. When them women said, we cannot live with you no longer, I understood that. I knew exactly what they would say, because I could never live with me. I could never get up and look in the mirror and be okay. I would get up there and I'd look in that mirror and I'd say, why? Why do you live this way? What's wrong with you? Why can't you be like your dad? Why can't you just go to work, come home, be happy with what you got? Why can't you be like your sister? She's a good person. She loves her family. She takes care of her kids. Her kids don't have to see what my kids see. I think, you know, why can't you be like your brother, you know? That kid got caught with alcohol when he was 13 years old. He went to jail. Dad went and got him. He said, I'll promise you, Dad, I'll never touch another drop of alcohol until I'm 21. He didn't. He didn't. I think, what's wrong with you, boy? You know, how can you do those things? I mean, I told Dad a lot of things in my life, but I never kept those promises I'd made. I made him promise after promise after promise. And I couldn't understand why I could not feel like those people. Why I couldn't be like them. And I'd be so irritable, restless. I didn't like the fact that I was writing bad checks. I didn't like the fact that I had bill collectors looking for me. And I thought, man, the only thing that would take those feelings away was alcohol. Once I started drinking, I didn't have to feel that way anymore. It was okay. It was okay. So I made another erring judgment. You know, I'd been married about 3 years, and, you know, my drinking progressed, and we had them little girls, and that first little girl was living with my first wife, but we had the two little girls in our house, and I went home one day, and I'd been drinking, and my wife started on me like she did so many times before, and I set her down, and I said, you know, what you need to do is you just need to have a few drinks, you know. If I had to sit around what you drink all the time, I'd be irritated too. What you need to do is you just need to have a few drinks. I said, if you just drink a little bit, you won't worry about how much I'm drinking. You won't count how much I'm drinking. You know, you'll just have a few drinks and you'll be okay. What I didn't know was, is when she started drinking, she was going to drink like I drink. Now, believe me, I was used to coming out of blackouts and looking around and seeing what I'd tore up and who I'd beat up. But now I'm coming out of the blackouts and the house is tore up and she's beating me up. Was an order. I can't go through with it. Yeah. And I can't tell you how many times that happened. And, you know, we sit here and we laugh about that this morning, but, you know, there was little girls that watched that going on in that household. When they would get up the next morning and see that house tore up and one of us beat up. I can remember going home from work and hearing them little girls saying, Daddy's home, and they'd run to that bedroom and they would shut that door. And I don't know about you, but when that happens to me, I have to drink. I have to take those feelings away. So I would go get me a drink, and once I had two or three drinks, they knew it was safe to come out for a while. And they would come out. And they never knew how long they was going to be able to stay out before they had to go back. And that's the way it was. I'm not proud of those things, but that's the way it was when I drank alcohol. I didn't go out and rob no banks. I didn't kill nobody that I know of. Yeah. I didn't do all those things when I drank alcohol. I just drank alcohol. And when I drank alcohol, I drank alcohol because I didn't like the way I was feeling. In November, in 1982, my dad, I hated my dad. I hated that man with a passion. And I hated him because I felt like I could never be what he wanted me to be. And I hated God because all he wanted to talk about was God. And I used to think, if there was a God, you know, I wouldn't be living this way. The last 9 months of my dad's life, my dad was paralyzed with cancer from the waist down. And I didn't go see my dad much because all my dad wanted to talk about was my drinking and God. And I used to go see him, and he would sit there or lay there flat in the bed, and he would tell me about God, and I would sit there and thank God, if there's a God, why is it that I'm living the life I'm living and you're living the life you're living? Yeah, you've been a good man. I know you've been a good man. I know you've tried hard your whole life. But why would a God do this to someone? I can understand maybe why God's after me. But if there's really a God, why are you living the life you're living? And so I didn't go see much. My dad died, you know, and I got to be with my dad the last 48 of hours of his life because my sister come and got me and took me. And she said, we're going to go stay with Dad till he dies. And my dad's last words to me was, you know, one more promise. You know, promise me you'll quit drinking, promise you'll take care of your mom. And I made that promise because that man was dying. And I left that hospital and went straight to the liquor store because I knew one more time I had told that man something I could never live. And I drank. In November 1983, my ex-wife at that time, we had been divorced for about 6 months, but it got to the point, you know, some of you will identify with this. You know, you can't live together, but you can't live apart. You know, two sickies just can't do it. And I was back in one time, and she went to Alcoholics Anonymous to get me sober. And as you can see this morning, it worked. Not that quick, but it worked. The sad thing about that is she's not here today. When she comes to Alcoholics Anonymous today, she stays sober. but she don't find it necessary to come here on a regular basis, and most of us know what happens to people that don't come here on a regular basis. They continue to drink again. And you know, I pray on a daily basis that maybe she can get back and give me what get so freely what she gave to me. And I'll be ever for grateful for that woman for bringing me here. But I came in on I didn't quit drinking there, you know. She brought home a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She brought home a lot of literature. And, you know, as I said, I'm on the scar of education. And there's no pictures and all that stuff. And so, you know, I knew it wasn't for me. I'd pick up that book, and there wasn't any pictures, so I laid it back down. And, you know, that literature, you know, I would think, you know, this is good for her. And I thought that because she wasn't beating me up no more, you know. And, but I'm not so sure I need this deal yet. But, and on January 2nd, 1984, you know, I came in from a New Year's Eve drunk. And that's how I drank. You know, when I'd go out on a New Year's Eve drunk, I'd get home about 2 days later, and I came in, and when I came in, she met me at the door. And she said, you can either go to Alcoholics, or go to AA, or you can go. And I didn't know a lot what she was talking about, you know. I just knew that morning I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and she could have said, you can go to Amway or go, and we'd been in Amway that night, because I didn't care, you know. I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. I have a friend that talks to about, you know, when the gig was up, and I really believe that I knew that day the gig was up. I knew that no longer I had a fight, and I was willing to go anywhere. And I went to the first AA meeting I'd ever went to in my life that night, and knew instantly I was an alcoholic. And if you're here this morning and you're comparing instead of identifying, you're not through yet. I can promise you that, because that's what I did to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no intentions of identifying with those people I went in and compared. All those people had been to treatment for alcoholism, and I had never been to treatment. I'm not a product this morning of any treatment center out there. I'm a product of the Alcoholics Anonymous, the old-timers who come and get you, take you to a meeting and let you sit there and shake and hope you don't die. You know, that's the way it was when I got here. But I went to that meeting. They talked a lot about treatment. They talked about God. They was in the basement of the church. They said some real smart stuff. There's a bunch of them. They was all old people, you know, that's Harlan's age or older, somewhere in there, you know. Yeah, I really liked Scott last night. Scott taught me. I never knew you could abuse your sponsor from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate that. But a bunch of old geezers sitting around there, and they was talking about God and talking about not drinking, you know. And they said, we need you. And I turned around and looked because I wanted to make sure they was talking to me. And I looked over, and there's about 14 stairs, and I looked back over, and I said, I bet you do. I bet you. I'm going to have to carry every one of you out of here tonight, probably. So they said, you keep coming back. They told me some smart stuff, like I probably had some brain damage, and that wasn't no big news, because I had report cards from the Carthage school system that showed I had brain damage long before I took a drink of alcohol. You know, so needless to say, you know, I didn't identify very much at that meeting that day, but I had nowhere else to go. Nowhere else to go. And I came back to two or three, four or five, I don't know. I came back to some more meetings. And the only thing I realized is, you know, they said, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And I bought that, and I walked out of a meeting one night, and I turned to my ex-wife, and I said, you know, we don't need to go to those meetings no more. I got this deal. Somewhere down the line, they're going to want money, and we don't got it. So I says, we just won't drink one day at a time. We won't get drunk. We don't need to go to meetings to do that. We can do it by ourselves. And she did, and I didn't. And, you know, I don't know how long I lasted. And finally, I was back out one more time. And, you know, when I went out this time, I got arrested one night, and I went to jail. And this officer wrote up a bunch of tickets, and I don't know what I'd done, but evidently he didn't like it because he wrote for about an hour. And he handed me all these tickets and told me to sign them. Well, you don't hand anything to a drunk and tell him to sign it. He tears it up and gives it back to you, and you get pissed off, and the fight's on. But one more time, I was you know, I had people who knew me that could keep me out of trouble. And, you know, I'd called my prosecuting buddy, and he wasn't in town that week. And I thought I was in big trouble, but this jailer had called someone to come get me and took me home. And I started drinking alone, and I'm not a loner. You know, when I drink, I like to be out where the action is. You know, I like the neons and the nylons. You know, I'm not sitting home drinking by myself, but that's what I'm doing now. I go to work each day, I get up, I go home, and I drink. And I drink until I black out, until I pass out. And I look at them four walls, and I know this is it. I know this is it, because there's nothing else. There's nothing else. I'm too paranoid to go out there. My prosecuting buddy got me out of trouble. He went to the chief of police and told him, you know, if you arrest him one more time, I won't prosecute him. So he didn't lie that night when he said he was living in his car. He was living in his car, you know. I mean, when they ask you for an address, you tell them an address. If you're living in your car, you're living in your car. And that's where I was living at that time. And, you know, it gave me a free ride one more time, you know. I got brave enough to go out once in a while, and I would go down the main street of a town of 5,000. I'd throw my beer cans out at the cops or whiskey bottles, whatever, just let them know it was me. And, knowing that they couldn't really do anything about it because he was going to keep me out of trouble. But what happens when you do that, you get real paranoid because these stories come back to you about you're not going to live on the river, you're going to live under the river, you know. And so I got to where I wouldn't go out at night because I thought the cops was after me when I got sober and came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a little old gal named Millie in Joplin, and Millie said, "Dave, paranoia is when you think you're out to get you. Believe me, those people was out to get you." So, you know, I'm sitting there just drinking and doing my deal. And, you know, I get up and I go to work each morning. And some days you get up and the car's there, and some days it's not, you know. And if it's not there, you walk to work. If you're still not through, you know, and you have a job, make sure you live close to that job. Because some days you'll drive and some days you'll walk. And if you got to walk, you know, you don't have far to walk. So I live close to work and I'd walk to work. And one morning on June the 13th of 1984, you know, I went to the Elks Clubs because that's where I went when I didn't work. And I was a bartender there, and I went down to the Elks Club, and I got the bar ready to open, and we had a swimming pool out there we took care of. And I started drinking that morning or early afternoon, and sometime that evening I blacked out, and later on I passed out, and I woke up the next morning one more time without my car. And, you know, Scott talked about pukers. You know, I love to puke. It's dry heaves that damn near killed me. Yeah. It's when there's nothing else to puke and you're still there and there's no feeling like it. If you've not had that, you know, I feel for you. You know, you'll have a spiritual awakening, I'll guarantee you. And because you don't know where you're coming or going, and your eyeballs you think are going to pop out, and there you are, and there's nothing else to do but stay. And man, you do some deep meditation that day. And I did that day, and I got up and I walked to work because my car wasn't there that day. And I got to work, and I'm a high-bottom drunk. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a job, I had a car, and I had a place to live. And I had a car because my dad had died in 1982 and my mother didn't drive. She gave me that car. And I had a place to live because my sister was paying rent on an apartment for me. So I didn't have to live in my car and on the streets. And I had a job because I worked for my brother-in-law and my sister wouldn't let him fire me. High bottom drunk. Yeah. She said, "We're paying his rent now. You know, imagine what we'll have to give him drinking money if he don't work." So I went to work that day, and I worked in a grocery store, and I went back in the cooler and I got me one more drink because I had to drink to get rid of the shakes so I could do any work. And I went out there and tried to work, and a man came in, and he seen me. He started talking to me. He started talking to me about him. And he talked to me about a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he wanted to know if I'd ever been. And I said, "Yeah, I've been there. I've been there. You know, and it's a good people, good program for people who don't want to drink. But I'm not an alcoholic. My problems are far, far deeper from alcohol." And I said, "I might have a few problems now, but they'll go away, and I don't want to not drink forever." And this guy just told me about his life. and about what happened. He didn't have to do this one day at a time, and by one day at a time, he had had a year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and how much better his life was. And he left, and when he left, he didn't tell me I need to go to AA, or I ought to go to AA, or he'd take me to AA. He left. And some time went by, and another guy came in, and he told me the same story. He told me about his life and what happened in his life, and he hadn't had to take a drink in 6 months because he went to AA on a regular basis, and how much better his life had got. And this guy left. And he never told me that I needed to go to AA or I ought to go to AA or he would take me to AA. He just left. Yeah. I'll always be grateful for those guys because, you know, I've never sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with either one of them guys. I don't know whether they're sober or drunk today. I have no idea. I have never seen them again. And I say I've never seen them again. That's not quite true. I did see them for maybe two or three times after that because they were salesmen, and they came in that store on a regular basis. And right after that, one of them had moved to Dallas, and the other one, he lived in northern Missouri, and I've just never run across them again. But I didn't tell them, and I had no intentions of going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't intend to leave that job that day and go to a meeting with A&A, you know, because I knew it wasn't for me. I knew, you know, Scott talked about, you know, the simple-minded people. You know, that's who I thought it was for, those simple, you know. Yeah, you get drunk and have a wreck or something. You know, you run to AA, straighten your life out. You know, my problem, I'm underfinanced. That's my problem. You know, I'm just underfinanced. If I could just get my finances in order, I'd be all right. I've got bill collectors looking for me. I got ex-wives looking for me wanting child support. I've got bad checks all over town. You know, that's my problem. If I could just get that in order, alcohol wouldn't be the problem. You know, I'll be all right. But I left that job that day at 4 o'clock, and I walked down, got in my car, and I went to the post office, and that's somewhere you never went if you lived the life I lived, because you're not getting no love letters. Mom's not writing to you to see how you're doing. You know, there's a whole bunch of threat mail there, and it's what we're going to do if you don't do, and, you know, I'm used to that. And went down there, and I run into a Catholic priest. It's ironic, you know, get to hear one, an ex-Catholic priest tomorrow morning. That's his story. But, y'all, this guy, I didn't like him the first time I met him, and I liked him even less this time. And he just took one look at me. He just took one look at me and said, "You ready to come back, boy?" And I don't know any more today than what I knew that day, but I said yes. I said yes. And I didn't know that I was never going to have to take a drink of alcohol again from that day to this. I didn't know that. Because I didn't want to come back here. I knew that I would never stay here, that this wasn't it for me. But I said yes. And he told me, he said, "You go home today, and you don't drink tonight, and tomorrow night I'll pick you up and take you to a meeting." And I went home that day and I didn't drink. I shook a lot, but I didn't drink. And I didn't drink the next day, and he come by the next night, and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's basically what I'm here to talk about today. Because when I came back, it was the last place on earth I wanted to be. But yet it was only people on the face of earth that wanted to have anything to do with me. And I'll always be grateful for that. It seems like the more you don't want to be here, the more they love you, you know? And they tell you all kinds of stuff. You know, I went back to that group, and I don't knock Alcoholics Anonymous, but those people in that group, they didn't believe in sponsorship. They didn't believe in big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's some still people in that group that's running that group that's been sober a lot of years. It's never done a four-step. And I'm glad that works for them. I really am. But I couldn't relate to anything they said. They kept saying, "If you don't drink, you'll feel better." And, yeah, I felt better, but not the way they was talking about. And they told me my life was going to get better. My life didn't get better. I continued to write bad checks. I didn't pay them bills. I didn't try to pay that child support. You know, I just didn't drink. And, you know, if you don't drink for about 90 days, that ex-wife will come back, start talking to you, you know. About that time, she decided to move back to Southwest Missouri, so I thought I needed to change in life. And, you know, I'd been in the grocery business for about 17 years working in a grocery store, so I went to work in a dynamite factory. Yeah. Don't do that. Don't do that. You don't want to work there sober. Yeah. If you work in a dynamite factory, you need to drink. You'll go to work some days and you'll realize you're the only sober one in that building. Now that's insanity. Best job I ever had. It was the best job I ever had. Paid a lot of money, worked a lot of hours. You know, I got down there, decided when I got down there, you know, I'd move in with Mom. You know, I didn't think she'd done a very good job raising me the first time, so I thought I'd give her a second shot at it. So I moved in with Mother and went to work in a dynamite factory, and I thought, boy, I don't need AA. Just a bunch of old guys sitting in basements of churches, reading out of a blue book, talking about God, talking about not drinking. Not my kind of life. You know, I can stay sober, but I don't need to go to AA. Stayed sober 2 weeks, and I'm nuts. So I went to a meeting. Give me a little blue card, a meeting schedule, and a bunch of old men in the basement of a church reading out of a blue book, talking about God, not drinking one day at a time. Again, I said, y'all, it's just not going to work. I made it 2 more weeks, and I'm climbing off the walls, and so I got that card out, and I said, here's an open meeting. I'll go over here to this open meeting. I know what open meetings are. They're meetings like this. You got a guy up there talks for an hour. You don't know what he says. He don't know what he says. He bores you half to death. You think he's never going to sit down and shut up. But nobody bothers you, so I'll go over there. So I went over to that meeting and walked in, and it was a round table in the hospital cafeteria. And there was 7 people sitting there. And I got there at 5 minutes till, you know. Just like I'm playing, 5 minutes till, 5 minutes when the meeting's over, get out of there so you don't have to talk. So I get there 5 minutes till, there's 7 people at that table. 3 of them jump up and run over the door to meet me. One of them was an old man named Dan. The other one was a little lady named Millie. And the other one was a guy named Robbie. 2 of those guys are dead today. Millie is still a big part of my sobriety. But Dan, they welcomed me and told me he was glad I was there. Got me a cup of coffee and we sat down. I don't know why Dan told me some things he did, but the first thing he told me, he said, boy, I'm going to tell you this. He says, I'd rather you hate my guts and tell you the truth than lie to you to be your friend. And boy, I found the meaning out of that real quick. He didn't care about hurting your feelings at all. He didn't read in there that alcoholics are sensitive people. Pretty obvious he has not been in the big book. And he didn't care. When he said he didn't care, he didn't care. They had a group conscience one night. You know how that is? It's the 3 people that got the most sobriety do the talking, you do the listening, and no one else votes what they say goes. Well, Dan and I, well, I had less than a year, but Dan had a month more than I had, so Dan got to be treasurer of the group. I didn't smoke. 7 people. I'm the 8th one. I'm the one that don't smoke, so I get the ashtrays. Now, my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll guarantee you. But what I had to do is I had to get there 30 minutes early to put the ashtrays out for those who smoke. Then you have to stay late to clean the ashtrays out of those for those who smoke. So they'll have clean ashtrays next time they want to smoke. Dan got drunk. Dan got drunk. I stayed sober. So grateful I didn't get to pick my jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Tough group. My group, we give chips out every meeting. This group, if you had a chip coming, you had to stay sober till birthday night. You could get that white chip anytime you wanted. But if you wanted a 30-day, 6-day, 90-day, 6 months, and any other chip, you had to stay sober till birthday night. Bunch of candies coming in Alcoholics Anonymous today because we're just giving chips. Well, you got to give them a chip now because, you know, they might get drunk before they get their, you know, birthday night. By all means, we don't want them to have to wait another 10 days for a chip. So, birthday night rolled around. 6 months. Old man called me up to a podium like this. He reached under the podium and he had a half a cake. And he said, boy, I'm going to tell you something. He says, usually we give whole cakes here, but he said, you're not going to make it and I don't want to miss it, so here, give me a half a cake. Second resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you couldn't have paid me enough to drink the next 6 months. Don't make that old man eat them words. Now, I stayed sober. Stayed sober a year in Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't have a sponsor. One showed them, don't need a sponsor. You can do this deal on your own. If you're new, hear this. You know what you're going to do if you stay sober by yourself without getting a sponsor and working any steps in Alcoholics Anonymous for a year? If you're anything like me, you're going to load a shotgun 3 times and put it to your head and want to die. Because you're not going to change anything. You're not going to quit writing bad checks. You're not going to pay bill collectors. You ain't going to be a father to those kids. You're not going to pay that child support. You're just going to not drink, and you're going to be miserable, and there's a lot of people around you going to be miserable. Because I'm the type of guy, when I'm mad and angry, I'm going to make damn sure you are. And that's what happened. If I'm going to AA, I'm not drinking, and I'm real miserable. And when I got that year cake, if they suggested I have a sponsor, I got a sponsor, and we worked the steps to the best of my ability. I went out there, and I tried to make some amends. I went to that first ex-wife. I told her I was alcoholic, and I wasn't going to tell you what she said. Yeah. I tried to clean my language up today. You know, when I came up here this morning, I asked God not to let me use foul language. And, you know, if you catch me using foul language today, it's because God didn't listen. But I went to ex-wife and I told her, I said, you know, I've done you some wrongs. And she said, yeah, you have. And I said, my sponsor told me I need to come and ask you, you know, what I need to do to make all them wrongs right. And she looked me right in the eye and said, die. I'm living proof. Half measures will avail you something. You know. But one more time, I knew those steps didn't work. You know, and I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that sponsor ended up doing some things that he shouldn't do while sober, and because he got where he didn't drink, but he didn't go to meetings, and he ended up in penitentiary. And I got another sponsor, and this sponsor believed in service work, and he got me real involved in service work, and you know, I thought that's where it was at. And I'm 3 years sober, and I'm sitting at his kitchen table one day, and we're talking about my financial situation, and we hear something, and well, we're talking about my financial situation. He's telling me everything I need to do. We go to the door, and they're repossessing his vehicle. Now, you guys laugh, but I went back to that table and continued to listen. So, that's the way it was. That's the way it was. I'd done a lot of things I wasn't proud of. I was 3 years sober. I was dating a girl half my age. And I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked cool. I looked real cool. But I'd go home at night, and I'd lay on my head on that pillow, and I couldn't sleep because I knew I wasn't cool. I knew I wasn't cool. I had a daughter her age, and I knew what I was doing wasn't right. And I couldn't sleep. And we was laid off from work, had a little time off, and we was running around Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to lots of meetings, and boy, I'll tell you what, if you go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't drink, you know, you'll be all right. But if you don't work the steps, if you don't get in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be nuts. Because what you hear in Alcoholics today, Alcoholics Anonymous today and a lot of meetings I go to has absolutely nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll guarantee you that. And there's a big difference in meetings and fellowship and the program that Scott talked about. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And unless you work and rework those steps, there's nothing going to change your life. And that's what was happening to me. As I was going to meetings and I was not drinking, and my life was just getting more crazier than it had ever been in my life. And we went to a convention in Tyler, Texas. And it was the year they had the ice storm. And we drove across ice to go there because they told us we couldn't make it, so we left a day early. And we went. And as the guy got up there, I'd heard this guy 1,000 times. I had a tape of his, and I'd listen to this tape over and over again. And the only thing I could think is I thought this was the most arrogant guy I'd ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. I could never hear what he was trying to say. And what I was doing was comparing. And the night he got up there and spoke, and he wasn't even supposed to speak. He was supposed to chair a meeting because the speaker couldn't make it in because of the ice storm. He spoke. He told my story. And I hooked up with this guy. And my life, he got me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My life changed. I went home and I ended that relationship about 6 months later. He told me, I want you to make a decision on that relationship. He said, I either want you to go home and end it now, or he said, I want you to give it the best 6 months you ever gave anything in your life. Well, I'm sick. I'm not stupid. I'm not going to give up a good thing now, so, I'll give it 6 months. But in 6 months, I ended that relationship because I knew it was a sick relationship. A lot of things happened in my life. He became my sponsor, and I got real involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and quit messing around with the fellowship so much. I got to make amends to a lot of people I'd harmed. I got to love my kids, be a part of their lives. I had that youngest daughter, she's always been close to me. Through it all, she just always felt, that she needed to be close to her dad. And that oldest daughter, she was just the joy of my life from day one. And, our relationship had never been close, but it got closer than it had ever been. I got to see her walk across stage to get her diploma one night, and I almost missed that. I almost missed that because of my fear and my ego. I got up one morning, I was living in Tyler, Texas, and I just got a new job, and I'm always the type of person that if you go to work for someone, you ought to give them everything you got. And I didn't feel like I deserved to ask off to go to my daughter's graduation because I hadn't been on the job very long. And I got up, I was living with my sponsor and his wife at that time, and I got up that morning, got ready to go to work, and he could tell I was down. He called me in his office and asked me what was going on, and I told him. He said, I want you to go in there and pack you some clothes. And he said, you go by and tell your employer you're going to Missouri to your daughter's graduation. And he said, if that employer fires you, you'll find another job. But that girl only graduates once. Jobs will come and go. And I went and got in my car, and I drove 6 hours to get there, and I made it. And when I did, that little girl came across that stage, and she had tears in her eyes because I was there. I'm grateful. I'm grateful for strong sponsorship, for people telling me what I need to do. This guy, I went to Tyler, Texas to make a fortune. I had got laid off that dynamite factory, and they told me it's going to be a while before we got back to work, and said, why don't you go find something else, and we get ready to call you back. We will. And so I moved to Tyler, Texas with my sponsor and his wife. They was moving down there. I thought, he's got enough pull. He can get me a good job here. Everything's going to be all right. My life's going to get better than it's ever been. And I got to Tyler, Texas, and he opened the treatment center, and we started a meeting over there. And it became one of the largest meetings in Tyler, Texas at that time. And we got to work with a lot of new drunks. And, life was great. I met a young man who... He didn't come through the treatment center. He came there one night to a meeting, and he told me that he needed a sponsor. This kid had been through 7 treatment centers. He'd been through Hazleton, some of the finest. His folks was millionaires, and they'd send him to some of the finest places in the country. And his dad at that time was paying for this little gadget on his car that he had to blow in it to start it, to make sure he wasn't drinking. He come and asked me to be a sponsor, and I told him I can only teach you what, has been taught to me, and I started sponsoring this kid, in October, this kid's going to have 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He is now the CEO of his dad's company, and I went there to get rich. another young lady come through that treatment center, you know, Tammy had been in 8 or 9 universities and dropped out because of drinking and drugging. And Tammy was a program of attraction. She had half her head shaved and it was dyed, and she wore t-shirts with no bras. I wanted to know why another woman wanted nothing to do with her. And I sponsored Tammy on a little ego trip because I wanted to think I could do something that I shouldn't be doing. And I did. And sometimes ego works in your favor. And what happened is because I wanted to prove this bill was worth, you know, my wife and I a couple years ago got to go to Tyler, Texas and watch Tammy walk across the stage and pick up a diploma. And she became a young lady. She got married and she's had a baby and she sponsored a lot of women in AA, and now she's chose to go to church more than AA, and that's her life, you know. But I went there to get rich, not to carry a message, just to get rich. And I don't tell you those stories to brag. I tell you those stories because I don't know what God's got in store for me each day. I don't know what's happening. I went back in 1990. Yeah, my wife likes me to tell this one, so I'm going to tell this one. I went to business for myself in Tyler, Texas. I started a yard business in Tyler, Texas in January. Yeah. I went broke in the yard business in Tyler, Texas in February. Yeah. In May, that dynamite factory called me to come back to work, and I was real grateful. But I was going home, and I was going back to Missouri, and my mom had been real sick that year. She had a few heart attacks, me in and out of the hospital. And you know, when I called my mom and told her I was coming home, I told her, you know, send me a couple of newspapers because I had to find a place to live. My mom said, I want you to live with me. I didn't want to do that. Now, I'd been on my own now, and I've become self-supporting through my own contributions, and I wanted to live on my own, and I went and talked to my sponsor. I said, my mom wants me to come live with her because of her health. And he reminded me about that little promise I'd made my dad in 1982 about, you know, you'll quit drinking and you'll take care of your mother. He said, you've lived half of that promise. Why don't you go take care of the other half? So I got to go home and take care of my mother the last 6 months of her life. And it was a great feeling. There was no guilt. No guilt there. You know, when my mom died, I was all right. Because my mom became my best friend. You know, she loved it, but my mom never went to Al-Anon. She just loved what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for her son. She loved it. I was sitting there right after she died, about 2 months later, and you know, I called my sponsor. And, you know, I'd not been in a relationship in a long time. You know, I was in and out of those early in sobriety. So I realized, you know, maybe I need to learn to live with me before I try to screw up somebody else's life. And, yeah, that's pretty much what I did. I called my sponsor, and he said, well, maybe you ought to find someone and start dating. I said, how do you date? You know, I know how to take hostage, but I've never dated. You know, I don't know how to date. I called this lady up and I said, you know, you want to go to Springfield? They're having a speaker meeting up there. And so she called 3 or 4 other people. So when I found out she invited 3 or 4 other people, I just took off and went to Tyler for the weekend, called her and told her I wasn't going to make it. Go on to Springfield, have a good time. Because I just didn't know how to do anything like that. So next time I asked her out, I said, you know, I want to go on a date. It's like, it's just me and you. It's not me, you, and 3 or 4 other people. I mean, at this time, I was driving a 2-seat Triumph. How are you going to haul a carload, you know? So she agreed to go, and we had knew each other for a few years, and, you know, we tried to date. But we don't know how to date. You know, we started dating in January. We got married in May. And I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Marjorie. And, you know, it's, not only do I not know how to date, I don't know how to be married. We got married, and when we decided we would communicate, and when we communicate, the people three blocks down the road hears communicate. And because people said you need to communicate, so we communicated. It's the only way we knew how. And I'm going nuts, and you know, I've got so much ego. I said, you know, I'll drink. You know, proven fact, if I drink, she'll leave. Nobody's ever stayed with me when I'm drinking. So I'll drink and she'll leave. Yeah, I'm not going to get divorced. So I got too much ego. Yeah, I've sat there on that side and I've judged those people that came in Alcoholics Anonymous, got married and got divorced, knew it and it wouldn't work. You know, I know Joe, he can't have a relationship. And thanks, Joe. And I knew what would happen if I got divorced, you know. People would be out there judging me. And I didn't want that to happen, so I'll just drink and she'll leave. So I started calling my sponsor, telling him about going to drink. And he thought maybe I ought to get a divorce instead of drink. And he's screaming divorce, and I'm screaming drink. And, you know, it's really a sick deal. And what happened is my sponsor loved me so much that he didn't know what to tell me. He had absolutely no idea, but he didn't want me to drink. And one day when we was on the phone arguing, he told me, he said, maybe you better find another sponsor. And it devastated. Just really devastated. Because here I am in a sick relationship. We got some financial problems, you know. And now I've lost my sponsor. And this is the guy that saved my life. Literally saved my life. And now I'm angry, and I really don't know what to do. And thank God for the old-timers of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. Because I went to a couple that's been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot of years. And they've been married for a lot of years. And they argue and fight as much today as the day they got married. And their name's Don and Norma. And I asked them how to be married. How do you be married? I don't know how to be married. And they spent time with me. Told me how to be married. And I'm so grateful for that. So grateful for that. Because, see, I would have lost my best friend. I'm married to my best friend today. And I'm married to my best friend because of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. The ones who care enough to tell you what you need to hear. Not the ones that tell you what you want to hear. And I don't criticize my sponsor for what he did. Because I know today he did the only thing he knows to do. And what happened is he and I became closer. We became closer. See, I owed him some financial amends. And I probably would have never paid those financial amends because he didn't want the money. He wanted my friendship more than he ever wanted anything. But what I had to do is I had to go to that man and pay him the money I owed him. And when I went and paid the man the money, he called me. He said because he wanted to spend the weekend with me. And that's how this deal works. You know, I can't stand here this morning and tell you all the things that's happened in my life since I got here because there's just so many of them. Those little girls, they grew up to be big girls. The oldest one, her and I had a relationship that was unbelievable. I got to walk her down the aisle when she got married. You know, she gave me a beautiful granddaughter. And everything was going great. She went through a divorce a couple of years ago. And when she went through that divorce, you know, I wanted to take responsibility for that. Because I figured if she hadn't had to watch that, she wouldn't have to live that. And I realized that wasn't my responsibility. That's her life. And what happened is that first ex-wife, I've tried over the years to make a lot of amends to that woman, but she'll never accept my amends. I know that today. And a year ago, she broke that relationship up with my daughter and I. And I wish that I could tell you today that that don't hurt. But the truth is that hurts. That really hurts. because we have a 5-year-old granddaughter, a 6-year-old granddaughter that we ain't seen over a year. And we had this little girl about every week, and that hurts. But I know it's all right, see, because I don't know what God's plan is. It's just I have to live it. I have to live it today. The youngest daughter, a few years ago, she come to me, and, you know, her mother had called me and told her she was living a life that she didn't agree with. And I called my daughter, and she come to talk to me, and we talked about it, and I didn't agree with it either. And I really wanted to disown that daughter. I really didn't want to own that daughter anymore. I wanted to just put her out of my life. And I went and talked to my sponsor at that time. And my sponsor had pointed out that all the years that I was drinking and I was an alcoholic and I was making her, embarrassing her and making her feel ashamed, she never disowned me. And what that done is that made my relationship with that girl that much closer. Today we have a good relationship. Her life's her life and my life is my life. She's comes to my home all the time, you know, she's my baby. We just had her 24th birthday a month ago, and she's a part of our life. My wife's got a couple of kids. She's got a son that, you know, it's amazing how God's worked. You know, he chose not to be a part of our life, and he has 2 grandsons, and he didn't want to be a part of our life for a long time, and we don't know why. You know, we took him to one meeting, of an AA meeting, and he got well. Said he would do this on his own and didn't want to be a part of our lives. But he had them 2 little grandsons, and about the time my daughter pulled out of our life, this boy called us and said he wanted to be a part of our life, and didn't want us missing them boys growing up. So God gave us 2 boys for 1 girl. You know, that's how it works here. Is God never takes, he don't give back. And I know that little girl will be back. I know he'll be back in God's time, not mine. But we got them 2 little boys, and then she's got a daughter who don't know where this kid come from. She went to college, got a degree, went to work, then decided she'd get married, now decided to have a kid. Yeah, my proposal was, you're what? So I don't know how you do those kind of things, and I know her mother didn't teach her those things. But our life's good today. It's good. I have a friend that used to be my sponsor over in Dallas, Texas. And, you know, a few years ago, he bought into a business with a gal that his fiance. And when he did, he got real busy, and we didn't get to spend much time together. And so I called him, told him I need to get a sponsor closer. And, you know, I did. And we've continued to be friends and call each other on a regular basis. And he bought into this business 3 years ago. He tried to get me to go to work for him, and I would tell him, I have a job. You know, when you get a position, call me. And because I don't want to work. And in November, he called me and said, I got the closest thing you're ever going to get from me is the position. And he said, I'd like for you to come to Dallas and talk to me. And so I went to Dallas in January and talked to him about this job he's got. And it sounded good. It sounded fun because he employs a lot of drunks. And he said, come down and work with us for a week and see whether you like doing this. And if you like doing this, maybe we can get something going for you up in Missouri. So I went to Dallas for a week and took a friend of mine, and we went to Dallas and we worked this for a week, and we had a blast, really enjoyed it. And we sit down and we talked, and I went home, and my wife said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to quit my job and go to work for John. She said, really? And she says, what did John offer you? And I said, he offered me an opportunity. And she looked at me and she said, that's nice, but we have bills. She says, did he offer you any money? I said, no, he didn't offer me any money. He just offered me an opportunity. And she said, you're going to quit your job and go to work for John for an opportunity? And I said, yeah. I won't repeat what she said. So, but there's some of you here that know my wife. My wife, she likes to worry a lot. So I just let her worry a lot, you know. And I've never worried because, when you've lived in your car and you lived in the gutters, you know, you don't have a lot of worry. You know, you don't have to worry about lights or food or anything like that. You know, you just live one day at a time. And so when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I really related to the one day at a time. I just go do it, whether it's right or wrong, because, you know, I know there's a program here to work that's going to make it all right. And so I don't worry, and she don't like that. She likes to worry, so I said, well, let's do it this way. I'm going to go work for John. You worry about it, and we'll make it all right, because I don't know what God's got in store for me tomorrow, you know. Everything I have today is just stuff. It's just stuff. It's God that's given me on loan. I've got some things I never dreamed I could have. I own a house today. I drive a brand new automobile today. You know, I have season tickets to a football team that don't know how to win today. You know? I just say that because I know you all are close to the Cowboys. You're going to tell me that anyway. But, yeah, I had things I never think I could have today, and they're just here on loan. They're just here one day at a time, as long as I keep doing what I'm doing today. And I'm going to close by saying this. I think it's real important that the new people hear this. We don't say it enough in the meetings I go to. The reason we're here today, is not because of a treatment center movement. The reason we're here today is not because the government put a bunch of finances in alcoholism. The reason we're here today is because there was a stockbroker in New York, went to Akron. And think about it for a minute. He didn't go to Akron to start AA. He went to Akron to get rich. He was going to put a deal together that's going to make him and Lois a bunch of money. I mean, can you imagine the conversation he would have had with God when he got down there and said, okay, God, now what? You know, I come down here to put this deal together, it fell through. And God says, Bill, I sent you there to start AA. What do you think Bill would have said? What would you have said? What would you have said? I know what I'd say. Well, I'm going to go down to the bar and drink a little bit and find some drunks. You know, ease the pain. Ah. Bill went and found another drunk to talk to, because he knew. Because that's what he had to do. I'll tell you some things he didn't do. He didn't go to a meeting. He didn't have no meetings. And yet we tell newcomers all the time, well, go to the meeting. Oh, going to meetings, fine. Why don't you tell them, write a post there. Oh, you'll hurt their feelings. That's why you don't tell them that. You know? He didn't tell him to write a gratitude list. There's nothing wrong with that. Not A. There's nothing wrong with it. He didn't tell him just go back up to the room and get on his knees and pray and just turn it over to God. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not knocking those things. But that's not A. He said, go find you another drunk. One-on-one, I don't know about the meetings you go to, but I'll do one-on-one any day as go to a meeting a lot of times. Because that's the language of the heart. That's one drunk talking to another drunk. And if that drunk's only got 24 hours, 48 hours, he'll know where to take him. He'll know where to take him. And we don't tell people that. You know, when I went to Tyler, Texas, I didn't go down there to help Bill and Tammy get sober. I went down there to get rich. I didn't know there was going to be two drunks wanting a message. So the next time you're sitting around and you're feeling sorry for yourself and things are not going well for you, think, just remember this. God, too, has a plan for you. Thank you very much.